My name, for those of you who don't know by this point in the afternoon, is Janet Kincaid. And I'm the co-chair for this year's Sunstone Symposium, and I have to say it's been an immense honor to be involved in this, but I'm really, really, this is the session that I have lived for the last 4 months. Michelle, you are so bad. You're going out, 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 out. Now, where did I put my notes? Be nice. I could make your life really miserable. Oh, wow. Brave boys. Make that one sit here on the front row. All right. It's about time. It's about time. All right. Everybody cozy? I know. It's a little warm, isn't it? I'm very sorry. I'm thinking... What was I thinking wearing that wool suit?
Can we take our cranberry shirts off?
Absolutely. Will you make a tie for me out of yours? Oh, you know what? I already have a cranberry tie. Oh, well. Anyway.
Are we supposed to bring mirrors?
Yeah, everybody get out their mirror. We're going to do that fried green tomatoes thing. Everybody. Rock your... No. That'd be a bit too much for me. Just keep it up. Just keep it up. The inception of these monologues began as a conversation between friends over dinner on Valentine's Day this year. The idea was passed to the chairpersons organizing this symposium this weekend. Taking the idea and running with it, this compilation then developed into a call for monologues that is culminating in this session today. And I would like to say, I think this is a historic moment. Inspired by Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues, women from across the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were invited to submit monologues about their faith and sexuality. Our collective experiences, discovering our sexuality, first-time sexual experiences, notions about sex, feelings about our bodies, relationships with men, relationships with women, living the law of chastity, not living the law of chastity, repenting of sexual misconduct, rejoicing in sexual liberation, are found here in this brave collection of women. The voices you will hear are poignant and honest. They are also angry, joyful, reflective, provocative, confused, but ultimately dynamic. In contributing to this work, each woman took a courageous step forward, full of integrity. It has been my privilege to be involved in this collection almost from the beginning, and I'm grateful to my friends who suggested it to me, Angela, Mary Ellen in the back. They were the ones who were having dinner, I believe. Lori, you were there? No? Joy was there. I'm sorry, Joy Ross. I rejoice in its inception, its conception, and ultimately today, its birth. I hope its reception will be outstanding or astounding. As these monologues are shared, I hope that we laugh. I hope that we cry. I hope that we rise up in protest and in solidarity. I hope we come away more determined and driven to continue working toward a day when our church will shed its latent fear of sexuality and teach its members, especially its women, to rejoice in their sentience, to embrace intimacy without the scourge of polarizing it between sinful and not sinful, and to own their bodies in an act of powerful, uplifting freedom. Oh, Anders, be a man. Married or single, widowed or divorced, straight or gay, abused or nurtured, temple marriage or civil union, we have all together here and in one voice proclaim our sacred space. Our first reading will be from a woman who currently lives in Morocco. She's a woman named Sylvia Cabas. She works for Catholic Relief Services in Morocco, and she has written an article that originally appeared in Exponent 2 called From Victoria's Secret to Beehive Clothing, and we'll be reading this piece. That will be followed by I'm just going to read these out so that you know where you come, because some of you have monologues. Ann Kanan, who will be reading on behalf of Patricia Hendricks, a piece entitled Please, Please, Please. She will be followed by, I need a volunteer. Who wants to read? Jerry Carden, who will read a piece called On Marrying After One's Youth. Angela Campbell, reading The Body. I don't even know, is that how you pronounce it? B-A-W-D-Y. I will then read a piece that was anonymously written called Twaddle Recall. And this will be followed by Mary Ellen Robertson, who will read New Testament 101. And she will be then followed by Jane Ann Peterson, who will read I Was Born Again, I Was a Born Again Virgin, Diary of a Mormon Vagina. So we'll proceed from there.
Okay, all right.
Is this the one you want?
Yes.
Please, please, please.
Sorry.
Okay. From Victoria Cooper to Beautiful. Absolutely. Okay. Do I say who it's by?
Sure.
Okay. Sylvia Cabot, M.A. Garments. I used to see them all the time in a combination of voyeurism on my part and exhibitionism on their part. They peek out from under too short Bermuda shorts. They flash under skirts when legs were crossed. They even show under collars when a handbag strap pulled the wrong way. They marked in dog members, distinguished them from mere recent converts like myself. Even as a baptized Taipei member, I did not feel like a real Mormon. I hadn't served a mission and seemed unlikely to, since my 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer probably counted as a secular mission for the U.S. government. Even as a tool of American foreign policy, not much was expected of me. If I was often mistaken for a nun, it was because I had to adopt over-the-knee skirts in order not to be mistaken for a prostitute. I am an over-educated, single, bi-coastal Mormon. I study gender and international development in graduate school. I don't have a perm. I am an alumna of UC Berkeley, the great Satan of university. I'm just reading that. My only time in Utah consists of one weekend trip. I don't have a Franklin planner. I have never read Stephen Covey. I have no experience with resin grapes, Minerva teacher, tiger paintings, or green jello. I turned down a full scholarship to BYU for graduate school, even though I was told that I could get married there. That was before I was informed I'd already been priced out of the Utah marriage market. Admittedly, I have a collection of flowered dresses, even some with matching hair accessories. Then again, I was told I couldn't wear pants to church. Now, however, wear garments. My life as a convert followed the same basic pattern: baptism, patriarchal blessing, endowment, perhaps marriage and family to anticipate as well. I knew that I would be going to the temple upon my 1 year anniversary as a Mormon, and consequently, my lingerie days would be over. No more annual shopping trips to Victoria's Secret on Valentine's for me. During the first year after my baptism, I went through a major transition. Summer in Montreal, I attended the French-speaking ward and took advantage of the exchange rate and the August sale to buy an impressive array of lingerie. Autumn in Washington, D.C. I get my first real look at garments in a shared dressing room at JCPenney with a friend on the ward. They look innocuous and sedate. I start taking the temple prep course and read a couple books on the subject. I experience my first encounter with the bleak discourse surrounding the temple. I remain confused. To gain cross-cultural perspectives on social change, I read an essay on veiling practices of Muslim women in Bali. I think I'm beginning to understand. Winter. Not until the evening before, as my escort and I are chatting, am I informed of the game plan for the next day. She and I have the ceremonial laying away of lingerie. As I take out each item, she oohs and ahs in admiration. I fold them neatly into a Talbot's bag, now relegated to closet Siberia. Spring. The day of my endowment, I wear my favorite, black and white zebra-striped undies under the most Molly Mormon dress I own. I pray fervently that Mormons inside temples do not possess x-ray vision. My first pair, dry silk.
Silk?
Baggy. I have a hard time putting on my pantyhose afterwards. The distribution center. A madhouse on a Saturday afternoon. I hurriedly finger the fabric samples and decide on the poly cottons. I am told to order more through the toll-free number. I go home and try on all my questionable clothes. Most can stay. A couple of short skirts and dresses have to go. That evening, I go to a dance party. I feel the extra layer keenly and wonder if anyone else notices. While I have been taking the missionary discussions, I bought a dress with the money I would have spent on the latest in reproductive technology. I can no longer wear this dress because of my garments. In an attempt at bravery, I wear thigh-high stockings to work. They roll down as I walk, down the hallway toward my boss, and I expose myself as I tug them upwards again. On the phone, my mother mentions seeing Steve Young on TV and wonders if he wears the funny underwear he talked about on 60 Minutes. I miss a golden chance to explain. I am now the proud owner of a 2-week supply. I only wear white bras these days. I have a favorite fabric and style of garments. I still feel them, but in a comfortable rather than constricting sense. I feel naked without them. I am naked without them.
By Patricia Hendricks. My sexuality, perhaps my experience as a woman, can be summed up as my desire to please. I can see myself as a young bride, a sunny, thin 20-year-old riding in the car with my new husband on our way home from the temple. The ceremony was over, the evening reception awaited, and we were driving toward a 5-hour black hole that my mother refused to plan, orchestrate, or even consider. In the car, my new husband slowly laid his hand along my back and then hesitantly crept his fingers down and inside my dress. He and I were both afraid of what he might find hiding under the dress, with bra and garments. Later, in the hotel room, I went into the bathroom to change, but I didn't know what to change into. I was so young and very virginal. I had lived the law of chastity to the letter. I didn't even watch R-rated movies. Before marriage, I let my husband's returned missionary conscience control how much necking would go on. I wanted him to want me, and was a bit confused by the stories in young women's lessons about having to control boys because they can't control themselves. I just never found those boys, I guess. The boys I dated before I was 19 never tried to do more than I wanted. In fact, they often tried to do less. While living at home, I shared a bedroom and bathroom with a sister who was 13 months older than I. Watched her apply toothpaste and other concoctions to hickeys on her neck and chest. I told myself I didn't want that. I was saving myself for my spouse. I was taught, and I believed, that I was some sort of commodity that I would present to this mythical white knight. So on my wedding day, while I was changing in the hotel bathroom, I desired to please my spouse. With him. I just didn't know how to go about it. I came out of the bathroom dressed in my robe. He began untying the bands around my waist and guffawed in amazement and credulity that I was still wearing a slip, a bra, pantyhose, and garments. He said, "What did you take off?" I had replaced my dress with my robe, and so essentially, I was still dressed. I was so ashamed. Just recently, my 19-year-old daughter and I were discussing Brittany Spears. She defended Brittany's right to dress as sexually as she desired. I suggested that young boys like her 10-year-old brother loved Brittany Spears, and perhaps she should take the age of her fans into consideration when choosing her wardrobe. My daughter quoted Brittany as saying, "I dress for me, not them." I wonder what would have happened in my life if I had the right to be a sexual being instead of a gift that was given to a sexual being. The shame of our first sexual encounter drove me to try harder to please. I became the energizer bunny. I kept going and going. Nothing diminished my anytime, anywhere motto. If he wanted it, he got it. Whether I was suffering from raging bladder infections, bulging pregnancy, flu, final, or what have you, I was the go girl. Or should I say, the go girl. My husband's obnoxious conservative attitude reinforced and perpetuated my need to please. As newlyweds, we attended a BYU fireside on sexuality. During the Q&A, the male speaker suggested that anything sexual was okay between a husband and wife as long as it ended in ejaculation. My husband and I discussed the ideas presented that night and decided that this was true. I had my litmus test. My need to please and my rubric of assessment, what more could a young bride need? Our first child was born 6 days before our first wedding anniversary. The doctor miscalculated the due date. He thought she was 3 weeks overdue and broke my water on December 24th. However, without the water to cushion the contractions, the cord wrapped around her neck and compromised the amount of oxygen my baby received in uterus. To save her life, the doctor entered my vagina with forceps and yanked the baby out. Excruciating labor and delivery ended, and we had a 5-pound baby girl. After the neonatal nurses whisked her off to the preemie nursery, the doctor began the arduous task of sewing me up. He spent over an hour stitching my torn uterus and surrounding tissue. I couldn't sit comfortably for several months. I experienced terrible backache for 6 years. But on my husband's 22nd birthday, 3 weeks after delivery, I bought a slinky, sexy teddy as a birthday present. I was really going to atone for all the clothing I wore on our wedding afternoon. I enticed him. I encouraged him. I masked the O's of the sore stitches with the R's of sexual pleasure. I wonder if he ever knew what that afternoon cost me. I raped myself with my incredible need to please him. I spent 14 years trying to please him without ever considering the personal cost. We had 6 children, so I was pregnant for or nursing for 12 of those years. He was in graduate school, aka never home, for 8 of them. During our move from Utah to Georgia and Georgia to Michigan, the biggest burden I carried was my need to please. Just following the birth of our 6th child, my husband was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis. In order to save his brain from a fatal accumulation of scar tissue, he began taking injections of beta interferon. The drug ravaged his body for 3 months until his body learned to accept it. He injected himself every other evening and then would climb wearily into bed to await the chills, nausea, other terrible drug-induced distress. Along with losing his humor, he lost his ability to have an erection. I couldn't please him. I could no longer pass the litmus test. He left me a few weeks later. And immediately began an intimate relationship with his 26-year-old graduate student. Apparently, the return of his erection coincided with his body's accepting of the drug. One of the many frantic and tear-stained encounters that accompanied our uncoupling, he snipped, "You make me impotent." I spent 4 years trying to pull myself together. Throughout the grief, I've cried and even berated the air. "Well, what about me? Did you ever consider how you made me feel?" But of course, it wasn't in our litmus test. My orgasm just didn't matter. It was a non-essential byproduct of sexuality. One time during a recent blind date. I decided that my sexuality did. I decided that I was a sexual being, that God created me as one, and I didn't need permission to act like one. I had sexual feelings, and I didn't need to apologize for them. When the Brazilian sucked my fingers, I took off all my clothes, garments included. His eyes exploded when I walked out without a single stitch on. I felt so sexy. I felt like a woman, sisters with Brittany and Shania. Sagging breasts, 20 pounds, stretch marks notwithstanding, I was sexy. Throughout the relationship, I told myself that I was a sexual being and that I could pursue my feelings, my desires. But I didn't. I listened to his divorce woes, his girlfriend's woes, his money woes. I cooked for him and wrote his resume. Although I told myself I was going to his house for romps to please me and discover my own sexuality, all I was really doing was feeding my need to please. This all became overly apparent when one day, while he was begging for a blowjob, I asked him, "What will you do for me?" He looked me right in the face and said, "I'll take a shower first." I laughed deeply and heartily, gathered my clothes, and never returned his phone call. 6 weeks later, I sat in the bishop's office to confess. I was embarrassed, humble, hopeful. He was kind, a bit full of himself, but patient. I think my confession pleased him. On marrying after one anonymous. It has always seemed so easy for some people to get married and have children. But somehow there's no question that they'll get engaged and have a lovely wedding. Then they'll go on to have at least 7 children. The daughter of a friend of mine who died of breast cancer 2 years ago wrote me this week to let me know she's pregnant. She said she thinks she'll miss her mother more than ever now that the daughter is pregnant with her first child. I doubt that getting married and having a child seems easy to someone who misses her mother, her best friend, almost every moment of every day. I miss her mother, too. Her life was so much more emotionally interesting than mine. Marriage came easily to her, so easily, in fact, that she was married several times. In those marriages, she had 3 children. She finally gave up marrying after the 4th marriage ended and just lived with the last partner, the last one before she died. She never wrote of him as if he were a lover, but instead, she told me what fine care he took of her as she went through round after round of chemotherapy and surgery. She tried for several years to eradicate the cancer that finally took her. I talked to that last partner after her funeral. He hadn't slept for days, or perhaps for months or years, and was close to hysteria. He later sent me several photos of her with her last child, most of them taken with the spectacular backdrop of Zion Park, with the little boy riding piggyback in a blue nylon and aluminum carrier on her back. My friend had called me when she was 42 and pregnant with that little boy. She'd just married him before. He was many years younger than she. I remember that she chuckled and said she hoped these old bones had enough life left in them for her to make it through the pregnancy. She had no idea in that innocent and relative view that she would survive the pregnancy, but not the boy's childhood. Well, she had the marriages I carried around the same reproductive equipment, but didn't use it. Sometimes I fantasized that it would be more convenient if I could just detach it like a computer peripheral and plug it back in,
should I happen to need it. That would certainly reduce the risk of cancer. A few months before my friend died, I wrote to tell her I was getting married. I asked her if she had any advice, since she's had more experience getting married than I had. She wrote back and said to not worry about not being ready to get married, because Christians are never ready to get married. And she said to throw myself into it with abandon and to give it everything I had. So relatively ancient bride that I was, I did that. She apologized for not being able to come to the wedding, but she died less than 2 months after my wedding. Her daughter spent many days at her bedside at the end. Now the daughter wishes that never see them to reverse those words. I used to think that love was the software in our life, that we could install one person, and if things didn't work out, we could uninstall that person and install another person. But now I know that love is the hardware. Once and we must never, never be the same again. I told my husband tonight that I'm glad we're making some recreational use of all that reproductive equipment that I called down for all these years. In our decidedly middle-aged life, it's not the use that most people think nature intended it for, I'm sure. But who are we to guess what nature intends?
I'm in Paris with my husband of less than a year, and we're wandering around the Arc de Triomphe. I'm thinking, what amazing architecture. The flowers are carved with such detail. What an amazing honor for someone no soldier. My husband says to me, there are breasts and penises poking out everywhere. I am amused and slightly embarrassed, hoping no one around us understands English. I am an uptight American. I was more than a little embarrassed about nakedness from the time I was old enough to recognize what it was. My first trip to Europe happened when I was 17, and I kept marveling and blushing at the nude and scantily clad statues I saw all over buildings and in museums. Even respectable places like the Vatican and public libraries sported images of naked human bodies. I wonder if the Puritans were all ugly. Were they fat or wiry, hairy people who hated the sight of their own nakedness? I mean, most of the people who first colonized this country and built our oldest buildings were from Europe, where those nude statues have been lurking about for centuries. Did the founding fathers and mothers leave home because of the statues? Why don't the public libraries in our country have naked humans for adornment? I was in India 3 years ago. They had all kinds of naked people on their buildings. They even have temples in Khajuraho with depictions of sex positions from the Kama Sutra carved all over the outside of the building, where any man, woman, or child can see. Some of these positions are hard to imagine getting into without help. In fact, there seem to be servants involved in holding the participants in position. I wonder if the artisans were using live models as they carved. I wonder who funded the building project. How is it that what is viewed on one side of the globe as art, as something beautiful enough to adorn holy temples and civic buildings, is relegated to the status of pornography on my side of the globe? Pin-up girls in lockers at school and in the bathrooms at taverns are about as decorative as the human body gets in America. Is it any wonder that sales of nudie magazines are so much higher over here than over there? They can see beautiful naked people at church or on the subway. I have to sneak to look at peeps in magazines. I remember the first time I saw a Playboy magazine. I was 9. And it was sitting there in the laundry room of the apartment complex where I lived. My sister and I would crouch next to the dryer vent and keep warm while it rained outside, and we would examine the pictures in the magazine. Would we look like these women someday? Is this what makes that desirable? How come everyone always looks so wet in these pictures? Now I'm a committed subscriber to Cosmopolitan magazine. My other favorite is Better Homes and Gardens. I read them both regularly. I find the pictures in Cosmo to be liberating and enticing. I want my skin to be as clear as this model, or my butt to be as tight as that actress's. Cosmo gives me a standard of outer beauty to strive for. And I really like the article. Now, I'm not saying that I think Mormons are especially uptight about the human body. I'm saying that I think Americans are uptight, and that in particular the Puritan Christian tradition in this country has created shame and secrecy around something so natural and normal as my own flesh. And speaking of my own flesh, like my breath. The left one is exactly 1.25 inches higher than the right one. And the right one is bigger and heavier than the left one. This is causing my right shoulder to sag just slightly. These soft, pillowy bags of flesh that grew out of my flat childhood chest are mine. I like to look at them. They feel interesting. The skin is soft and the pores are small. I enjoy all the nerve endings in them, especially in the areola and the nipple. I have no children, and breasts do not typically invoke maternal images for me. I see them as beautiful, womanly things that are sensual and comforting. I found out in my early 20s that I'm attracted to the female form. When I see a woman with a pleasing figure, I catch myself studying her as I would a perfect tulip, or a stunning Van Gogh or Monet. I already knew that I was attracted to men's bodies, although I never wanted pictures of naked men around. But I find the female form to be beautiful and desirable. I love the curves and the softness of the skin. I like the beauty I see in female faces and the texture of feminine hair. During my first marriage, I learned how to really enjoy sex. I learned that letting myself enjoy every inch of my lover's body and letting myself be appreciated in the same way was immensely satisfying. I like my breasts. If he likes them too and I can tell he's enjoying them, I'm fulfilled. Being admired in the same way that I admire myself and in the same way that I admire the beauty of other women makes me feel beautiful and desirable and so sexy. Still, I'm not comfortable with reveling in nakedness in public. Very few people know my nakedness. I guard it very carefully. I wish I didn't fear what others thought or desired of my body. I wish my natural form was not seen as bawdy or sinful in the eyes of my neighbors. I see the purpose in society for impressing modesty in each generation, but I also long for the freedom of Eden and Rio during Mardi Gras. At one and the same time, I'm both happy that the naked human form is a big deal in America, and I wish it weren't regarded as quite so scandalous. Maybe I will feel differently if I ever do have children.
First of all, let me say that I'm very honored to read this piece. The person who wrote it is here today, but has asked not to be named. And but it's called Swaddle's Recall. My vagina is being invaded. Memories. We're playing doctor in my backyard. I'm on an army cot set up among the camilla bushes, carefully placed so as not to be visible from the house. Actually, I'm playing patient. Marla, who lives two doors down, is the doctor. I never get to be the doctor. I'm always the one with my panties down around my knees getting examined, poked, and prodded. Much later, my mom said she walked into my room once when I was five or so, and Marla was about to insert something into me. She says she tried not to appear shocked, and quickly steered us towards a more innocent pastime. I'm trying to insert a tampon for the first time. That just goes without saying, we can end right here, right now. My friend Jill recommended the plastic applicator kind, more comfortable. I wore pads for the first year. I was so paranoid someone would see the pad bulge through my pants that I wore nothing but dresses the week of my period. Ding dong. Guess this time of the month it is. That's not in here. I'm just checking. I'm sorry. My apologies. I have the flu. I switched to tampons after my freshman year because of cheerleading. A blimp-sized pad between my legs while I was doing high kicks and partner stunts was just unthinkable. It took forever to get that tampon in. What if it falls out? What if it leaks? What if it gets stuck inside me and I can't get it out? Memory. Taking the tampon out was 20 times worse than trying to put it in. For the pain of extracting a sodden mass of fiber that had tripled in diameter since insertion. It was like fire. I stared at the then pink bathroom walls, thinking I was going to die before I could get that tampon out. I had to do this every month. Insert and extract these things several times a day. I quit. I don't want to be a woman. Maybe I'll squeeze this one in forever.
memory. Finally got the hang of tampons. It still hurts to pull out a supersized one, but now that I'm on the pill, my flow has dwindled to a trickle. I learned there's something worse than trying to pull out a sodden tampon. Trying to remove a relatively dry one. In things where you say, thinking about men's anatomy and they all cross their legs. It could be that leg crossing moment. Finally, man, you have your justice. I swear it's sweet. Like fingernails on a chalkboard, it sets me on edge to simultaneously hear and feel its exit. To the person who wrote this. anyway. Memory. I'm messing around with Brian at his grandparents' house. The family is out, and we're making the most of our time alone. Eventually, we're both naked and rolling around. He decides to put his finger in my vagina. It feels alien to me. He seems to be enjoying it. He was responsible for my first orgasm, so I'm not complaining. He's done. He's moved on, trying to insert his now flaccid penis into me. I get mad. Just because I allowed one body part inside doesn't mean it's a fucking free-for-all. Heavens, did I say this was a historical moment? I just said the update of Tombstone. I put my clothes on in a hurry, and he basically throws me out of a horse. How? You know, so right up there with my little clip earlier about spirituality and sexuality. He gets mad, too, calls me a tease. I put my clothes on in a hurry, and he basically throws me out of the house. He calls the next day and wants to take me to a movie. I need to stop dating Mormon boys. I see the gynecologist because I'm having pelvic pain between periods. She thinks I may have a cyst. She needs to come back for an ultrasound. Not being pregnant, I have to drink gallons of water, and I'm not allowed to urinate until after the exam is over. The nurse tells me to go into the restroom and wipe up, prep for the ultrasound. I come back into the exam room and change into the luxurious paper gown she's provided. She does the ultrasound, not saying much. Then she tells me she's not done. There's part of the exam that will be done with a probe. Excuse me? Did you say probe? I try not to wet myself. I think this is an age of modern medicine. They do surgery with microscopic instruments and cameras. How big can this probe be? It's huge! I'm spread-legged on the exam table looking at the elephantine probe, thinking there's no way that thing is going to fit in me. The end is bulbous on a slightly narrower shaft, very penile. The nurse loops it up with a dollop of KY jelly and says, "This doesn't hurt," as she proceeds to insert it. FYI, it does hurt. And now I really have to pee. I lay back, think of England, and hope to God Almighty that sex isn't like this. The nurse keeps pushing the probe in further and moves it around like she's stirring my insides to get a good look at the ovaries, she says. At this point, I almost don't care if there's anything wrong with them. I feel like I'm being raped by the probe, and I just want the whole thing to be over. And finally, I change into my clothes and pee for what seems like hours, wondering, am I still a virgin? Memory. I've plotted to have some time alone with a visiting beau. He tells his family we're going back to my house at the end of the day. We tell my family we're staying with his family overnight. No one will be the wiser. We shack up at a Howard Johnson. During a hot and heavy moment, his ragged fingernail catches on my lady and gives me a wickedly painful scratch. Another one of those leg crossing moments. It seems worse with every attempt he makes to get me off after that. If a mere scratch is this painful, I'm never going to survive giving birth. I see the gynecologist for next week. It's still painful. She writes a prescription for an ointment that should heal it faster. I vow never to let a poorly manicured pan anywhere near my vagina or its environs again. Memory. I'm in the throes of a loving relationship, wondering if it's time to feed my vagina. I love this man. He loves me. Despite all my cultural training and 101 young women's lessons on something marriage and morality, I'm wondering, would it be so terrible to be relieved of my virginity under these circumstances? I fought off many religious lovers, mostly fellow BYU students, because I wanted to be in love with my first partner. I had that with him. The feelings are mutual. It seems right to be considering it. Memory. Things aren't going so well. The man I wanted to be my first lover grows more distant every day. I miss the connection we once had, and I don't know how to get it back. In an attempt, I offer up my virginity to him. He waits patiently for me to be ready. He's told me how much it would mean to him. But he declines my offer, saying he wants the relationship to be on more solid ground first. We break up a few weeks later. To ease the pain of one part that misses him, I go on a shopping spree at Good Vibrations. What to do about my broken heart is less obvious. This is entitled New Testament 101. Almost everything I needed to know about female masturbation I learned in a BYU religion class. I can tell you afterwards if you really want to know, but not on the tape. It was a New Testament class, held in one of those fan-shaped rooms in a science building, the same room where I had Biology 101 and Physical Science. The professor was an energetic, white-haired, bespectacled guy whose detractors said he was running for general authority. He told entertaining stories about his big family and had students who came from big families stand and tell how many siblings he had. With only one sibling, my family was apparently beneath his notice. While some of the professor's stories were entertaining, I found it unfair that some of those stories found their way onto our exams. Rather than learning the text matter to the New Testament, the professor asked questions about a friend's dream about a cyclops that he told the class about. I thought it was a chicken shit way of making sure we showed up and stayed awake. I don't know how we got on the subject, but one day in class, the professor started talking about some of his experiences as a bishop counselor. He described a situation in which a woman in his ward, or maybe a student in his class, I can't remember which, came to him and described a problem she had. She masturbated. I remember being a little surprised that the professor was talking about a woman masturbating. Wasn't it far more likely that the men he counseled had more of a problem with that? It didn't even occur to me that women could or did masturbate. I looked around the room. Was anyone else finding this story astonishing? I couldn't really tell. The professor spoke at length about this, describing the weekly counseling sessions he had with this woman. He'd asked whether she'd been able to refrain from touching herself during the past week. Sometimes the answer was yes. More often, it seemed it was no. He would tell her about the horrors of this habit. He read scriptures, he read a miracle of forgiveness at her in an attempt to dissuade her from masturbating. I couldn't help but think it was inappropriate for the professor to be telling atheists and Testament students about what seemed an excruciatingly personal matter. He said that she eventually stopped masturbating after many sessions spent in his office discussing the issue with him. I wondered, did she really stop, or did she just stop telling him? I figured she lied to him and kept right on doing it, but maybe I'm projecting. And how did she figure out how to masturbate in the first place? I was a late bloomer in that respect. Even though I got a heads up about women being able to masturbate, thanks to New Testament class. You really
could get more for your educational dollar at BYU.
Look at where your talking is going.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would invest in my daughter to BYU, but not to
continue. I hope he's still teaching. Anyhow, even though I've gotten a heads up about women being able to masturbate thanks to New Testament class, I didn't exactly rush right home and try it for myself. I don't know why. A few years later, I met up with a guy who was able to bring me to orgasm, unlike awkward fumblings of the BYU boys I dated. When we broke up, I missed the new sensation of orgasm and decided to give it a go myself. And I've been a do-it-yourself gal ever since. Boyfriend for beating a hasty retreat so that I could, somewhat out of spite, learn to appreciate the art of going solo.
He seems to be thinking through the loud laughter and his clothes now. I was a born-again virgin, Diary of a Mormon Vagina. I'm pretty proud of my vagina lately. I mean, who knew that an essentially closed space could pass an object the size of a cantaloupe and survive to copulate again? Cantaloupe. The fact that billions of women had done it made it no less miraculous to me. But I should start at the beginning. Now, this may shock some of you, those of you who know me, but I had a fairly normal Mormon upbringing. Not normal Mormon, perhaps, since for all I know, the typical Mormon upbringing is nothing like mine, but normal and Mormon. We attended church every week without fail, had family meeting every Monday night, said family prayers twice a day, and read the scriptures over breakfast. We also were taught from the beginning to use regular anatomical terms in referring to our body parts. Not to say we were completely accurate, for us girls, in particular, the term vagina was understood as referring to the whole front crotchal area. I didn't spend a whole lot of time exploring down there, and it wasn't until many years later, maybe sex ed, that I realized there were three holes down there rather than two. Sex ed. In Oregon, as opposed to Utah, formal sex education started in fifth grade and was pretty thorough. But informal sex education started much earlier. I somehow mostly escaped playing doctor. I think the only time it was suggested, my mom discovered us and intervened before anyone got naked. But in second grade, Jennifer Fair, Sue Emmett's daughter, a third grader who also happened to be in my ward, whispered a rudimentary description of sex in my ear. The man sticks his penis in the lady's vagina. Yeah, I was incredulous. I pondered this piece of information all day, and that evening shared it with my brother as we were getting undressed for our bath and my mom was out of the room. My brother was in first grade. He said, "No, wait, really? You think we should try it?" In any case, compared to the shocking discovery that reproduction of our species was accomplished in such a bizarre manner, normal sex ed, which for girls was mostly about menstruation and how to manage it, was plain old boring. I turned 12, and two things happened. I got my period and started going to Mutual, not necessarily in that order. For the next 10 years, up to and including my years at BYU, which in so many ways was Academy for Girls Revisited, I and my cohort were subjected to an at least annual chastity talk, capital C, capital C. Bad science, sexist claptrap, false doctrine, and a healthy fillip of guilt on top, what more could a girl ask? At one BYU installment of the lecture series, given by the bishop of our ward during Sunday Relief Society, he actually delineated the distinction between light petting, and very heavy petting. Heaven knows what I would have done without that precious piece of knowledge. And does anyone else remember those funnel-shaped diagrams with commitment controlled by the boy on the one side and sexual involvement controlled by the girl on the other side? Because, of course, we all know that boys are incapable of controlling their sexual urges like an avalanche once they get going, and it's all your fault if you don't stop the murder. Don't even get me started on how mad that made and continues to make me. The fact that grown adults who should know better apparently believe in it lock, stock, and barrel boggles my mind. I'm also quite certain that at least one Mutual era lecture, We got a variant of the chewed gum slash crushed rose slash licked cake slash nailed board object lesson. I'm sure every girl in my generation got it at least once. Please tell me this excruciatingly wrong-headed practice has been eradicated. That's where the false doctrine part comes in. The fact is, through all of high school and college, my understanding of these issues was almost entirely academic, as opportunities to be unchaste were hardly beating the door down. Then, when I was 24, ripe old age, 24, things changed. I fell in love. He was even more inexperienced than I was. I think he had made out with one other woman, and I had made out with maybe a half dozen or so guys, which was exactly the same number as I'd tried. Probably felt a little easy. In our besotted state, we set about pushing the boundaries of taste for behavior further and further. There were a lot of firsts that summer and fall. I still remember the look of absolute rapture on his face the first time he almost reverently cupped my breasts in his hand. And each new foray into the taboo heightened our excitement. However, the final frontier, insertion of tab A into slot B, remained unbreached. And we, unsatisfied, our frustration was exquisite. 8 months later, I had moved to New York City and we had broken up. I spent most of the following few years in the second half of my 20s dating a few non-Mormon men and one highly experienced and much younger Mormon one. Having once faced what had seemed the ultimate temptation, intercourse with someone I truly loved and thought I was going to marry, and having resisted it, I found it increasingly easy to keep drawing the line just short of consummation. I became the world's most sexually experienced technical virgin. Ever ready for and never tiring of passionate kissing, fevered bumping and grinding, and naked rolling around. With an impressive collection of sex books, and earned a reputation by habitually giving the joy of sex as a wedding gift. For my sister, I nestled the pocket-sized edition in a crock pot. I wasn't obsessed per se, but it would be fair to say I was sex-focused. And then I married. Which is not to say that I no longer enjoy sex. It just no longer absorbs me the way it once did. Partly, I think it's because the thrill of the forbidden is gone. But I also think I'm also at least a little disillusioned. You see, everything I'd ever read or heard before I got married always talked about intercourse as the last and best part of sex, and everything else was mere foreplay. Even in writing by women, vaginal penetration was always the grand finale of any sexual escapade. And in the silly little charts in the chastity talks, it was a linear progression of sinfulness from French kissing through petting through oral sex and ending of intercourse. So naturally, I expected that pleasure would follow the same linear progression. I had had a very satisfying marital, non-penetrative sex life, and I imagined that marriage sex that included intercourse would be positively mind-blowing. So you can understand that when my wedding night arrived, and intercourse not only didn't send me to the pinnacle of pleasure, but was actually affirmatively uncomfortable, I was a bit bummed. What a letdown. All that anticipation, all that build-up, all that frustration, and instead of an explosion of ecstasy, I got a slow fizzle. The real kicker is, there was no way I could have known. Maybe it would have been better had I been less experienced. Maybe then I would have been so thrilled with any kind of sexual contact that I wouldn't have noticed that intercourse for me wasn't as fulfilling as it apparently was for Judith France and Erica John. But maybe not. You know, I think a lot of sexual dysfunction among Mormons originates not in discomfort with their sexuality, but in disappointment. Nothing could live up to that kind of height. Fortunately, sex got better as I learned to deal with my disappointment and as my body adjusted to the bizarre manner of reproduction in our species. We soon adopted a typical newlywed schedule of sex something like 5 times a week. Then we started trying to get me pregnant, and we were on a strict every other day schedule. Of course, time is nothing more than a paint memory now. I was not one of those lucky women whose sexual appetites go into overdrive during pregnancy. First, I was nauseated, and then I was bulky and awkward, and I couldn't stand any pressure on my abdomen even before I started to have a discernible belly. And things just felt different texture, different consistency, different sensitivity. And then there was childbirth and more disillusionment. I like to think I'm a pretty capable person. I generally don't spend much time worrying about whether or not I can do something. I just do it, and usually I succeed. I was prepared as I could have been. I read and studied multiple books on pregnancy and childbirth, attended natural childbirth classes, did prenatal yoga, and visualize my ideal labor and birth. I arranged to be surrounded in the delivery room by strong women, David's mother and grandmother and my mother and sister. I picked a midwife and a hospital who would be supportive of my birthing choices. What I didn't count on was an uncooperative baby. Anders stubbornly presented himself with his face to the side, not to the back, as is more normal, causing labor pains in both front and back instead of just one the other. I ended up having the epidural I had wished to avoid. Then I pushed, and he just would not move beyond a certain point. The pressure was unbelievably uncomfortable. I mean, camel is in the front. Hello? All the birth attendants stared hopefully at my descended vulva for over two long wee morning hours. Imagine he's like... While I pushed with all my might in several different positions, hoping to see more than just a sliver of head poking out, everyone's like, oh, you can see the head. Oh, you can still see the head. Finally, I vomited all the water I had dutifully been sipping throughout my labor. Lovely experience. And when he turned and came out, his hours of misdirection molded onto his misshapen skull. It was like a big knob on the side of his head. My child to be so busy patting himself on the back that he is born with his arms still wrapped around his neck, his elbow making a small tear in his mom's perineum and requiring a few stitches. Which brings me back to the present of the title of this piece. One of my girlfriends, who also had a baby recently, said that the first postpartum intercourse is like a medical procedure. Even after a few months of healing, intercourse is burning and painful, much worse than on our wedding night. I feel like that Foreigner song going through my head, yeah. Feels like the first time. But just like in the first few months of our marriage, matters have improved with time and gentle practice. Maybe by this time next year, when Anders will be sleeping through the night, we'll be back to where we once were. I want to thank everyone who was bold and courageous and submitted a piece. I know that there are others of you out there who want to submit pieces. We are going to continue gathering them, so please don't hesitate to email them to me. If you want my email address, call her afterwards, or you can write paperloop.com, jkincaid@paperloop.com, if you can remember that. If not, see me and I'll give it to you again. But we will keep gathering them. There is some talk about doing this. It's at the August Symposium in Lake City. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? Hey, no. I want you all to know right now, I'm sleeping with that woman tonight. She's staying in my room. We're just sharing a room. Anyway. So fast. Yeah, exactly. No, my parents, no, we're speaking again. Anyway. Don't ask. Anyway, I want to thank everybody that was here, and I certainly want to thank the men who were brave enough to be here and share their experience with us. You've just been elevated to honorary women. Well, that's true. And we wanted to see it, too. All right. So thank you very much. Thank you.